Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Thursday, March 28th, 2024. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the two words that say start here in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of the book contains a narrative description and explanation of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 19 years now to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click the link, download it, print it off, copy it as often as you'd like, and use it over and over again absolutely free. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And if you choose to do that, it will let you download a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. We hope people do all of that soon and often, primarily because it tends to improve the quality of people's lives the more they actively apply these tools in their lives, and secondarily because it tends to prompt comments, questions, answers, and testimonials. And if you have any of those to share with us, we'd appreciate you doing so by giving us a call at 563-999-3581. Once you call that number, if you press 1 on your phone, it'll put the little icon of a hand by your phone number. I'll then be able to turn on the microphone and announce you by your area code, and we can have a conversation. And if you would like to get some feedback or leave a testimonial and you do not have the ability to call in live or do not choose to call in live, you can send us an email. You can email me at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org, or you can email Jeannie at jeannie@whyagain.org. That's whyagain.org. And if we get a comment or a question from you through the email, we will address it on the internet show, and then as time allows, send you a notification about what day and time that occurred so you can listen back to the archives for your feedback or input. And we greatly appreciate whenever anybody does that because it makes it much, much easier for us to live into our intention with this work if we know how these things are landing for you, what's of most value for you. So we have plenty of time for comments and questions. The second hour today is going to be a recording because Michael is in a meeting. And so we have the flexibility of talking right up to the hour or ending early if there isn't anything pressing that's pressing down upon people that they want support with. And as always, we'll just go with the flow here and do our best to keep in the tradition of questioning anew whatever our mind tells us, especially if we are in any kind of an upset. Perhaps this is one of the most challenging things for anybody who steps into my office as a psychologist to deal with, is that one of the things I tell people as a core of my work is this observation that we find over and over again, that whenever I'm upset in any way, anger, fear, sadness, hurt, whatever, whatever my mind is telling me in that moment is not accurate. It's a lie, or it's based in a falsehood, and it's an old tape playing. It's not about the present moment. And the wisdom of that is brought to us through Course in Miracles and the Way of Mastery and a host of other deeply practical spiritual traditions. And the way the Course in Miracles says it is, I'm never upset for the reason I think I am. And the way I have it in the bottom line observations is, if I have a negative thought about myself or somebody else or a negative emotion active in my mind, I can instantly know three things. The first thing is, this is a lie or based in a falsehood. The second thing is, it's an old tape playing. And the third thing is, if I sit and spin thinking about it, if I speak or act from it, I'm just going to make my life situation worse, not better. And so that's essentially the same teachings from a variety of different places, that whenever I'm upset, whatever my mind is telling me about the situation is a lie. It's not accurate. It's not true. Now, one of the biggest, as I said, it's one of the hardest things for people to grasp when they start working with me. And one of the biggest examples I give to people for that is this idea that if I'm standing on a corner and it's peaceful, it's a sunny day, there's all kinds of people waiting on the corner to travel across the street in both directions, and all of a sudden somebody runs the traffic light or the stop sign and there's a T-bone accident in the middle of the intersection. And where there was calm moments before, now there's broken glass, bent metal, and bloody bodies. If in that moment my mind throws up at me horror, fear, anger, or sadness, these are old emotions coming to the surface. It's not about the accident in front of me. If I recoil in fear, it's an old emotion of fear. If I feel rage at the person that ran the light and caused the accident, it's an old emotion of rage. And you might say, as many people do when I talk about this in sessions, how could you say that? Of course you're upset about that. And I say, no, that's not really what's happening. And if you slow it down for yourself and or if you talk to people who are first responders, you'll understand that there's a different mechanism going on there. If I'm a competent adult on the scene and an accident like that happens, what's going to happen? I'm not going to be full of anger or fear or sadness or confusion what's going to happen is the truth of the situation is going to act on me. And if I have training in logistics, I might start shouting out orders to people. Hey, you help him with that over there. You call 911. You do this here. If I have training in paramedics and medical skill, I'll just start applying pressure to wounds. I'll start, if I'm one of these great, big, strong athletes that can, you know, bench or deadlift, you know, twice, three times my body weight, I might start lifting the car off of somebody. Action will flow from me if I'm awake and aware in the moment. I will not be subjected to the production of emotion. I will simply let the truth of the moment act on me, and I will respond with action. I take this even further and I say, and then let's say that, you know, the fire department, the paramedics are called, the people are all gotten out of the vehicles and they're whisked away in the ambulances, and then it's an hour or so later and I'm sitting on the curb because I've been actively involved in, you know, prying people out of the cars and helping staunch the bloody wounds and all, and I'm sitting on a curb an hour later and my knees are pulled up to my chin and I'm shaking, and a paramedic comes over and says, oh my gosh, you're going into shock. Here's a blanket, put your feet up, etc. What am I going into shock over? Am I going into shock over what's happening in that moment? No, I'm going into shock over my thoughts about what happened in the past and the car accident and what happened and who could have died and maybe somebody did die and maybe judging myself for not acting fast enough. And that's how I'm generating the negative emotions that I'm experiencing. It's not about what's going on in the present moment. It never is. And the more we can bring ourselves to actively observe this, the better our lives can be. Because the more we will begin stepping into how we're producing our emotions and what we might do differently. Whenever we generate an emotion that we don't prefer. I was just having a session with somebody where I was trying to bring this observation to his awareness for the first time. And it's stunning. It's shocking to our sensibilities because it's quite literally the opposite of what we've been trained to believe. We are not trained to observe that the cause of our emotions is inside of us. We are trained to believe that what happens around us is causing our emotions and our responses to given situations. And I just want to highlight the fact that not only is that not true now, it has never been true. It never will be true. The only cause of emotions in a human being is what that person is doing with his or her mind energy in the moment. This is why the Way of Mastery calls us so clearly to pay attention to what we're choosing to focus our attention on. It calls us to absolutely step into 100% responsibility for the way we are using this creative force that we call thought or mind energy. So our call-in number is 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1 on your phone, we can have a conversation. Or we can go back to what I was reading earlier this morning in the Anthony DeMello book. He talks about how happiness happens. He asks us to come home to ourselves, to observe ourselves. And self-observation being a delightful and extraordinary thing. Can you do self-observation such that you witness everything happening to you and around you as though it were happening to somebody else? When you get to the point that you're doing that, you have this different experience of life. Some call it happiness. But it's living in awareness. There's a story of a disciple who went to the master and said, could you give me a word of wisdom? Could you tell me something that could guide me through my days? And it just so happened that that was his master's day of silence. So the master picked up a pad and he said, and wrote on it, awareness. One word, awareness. Now, when the disciple saw that word, he said, oh, excuse me, sir, but this is too brief. Can you expand on it a bit? So the master took back the pad and wrote, awareness, awareness, awareness. The disciple said, yes, but what does it mean? The master took back the pad and wrote, awareness, awareness, awareness means awareness. That's what it is to watch yourself. No one can show you how to do it because that person would be giving you a technique. That person would be programming you. Just watch yourself. When you talk to someone, are you aware of it or are you simply identifying with it? When you got angry with someone, were you aware that you were angry or were you simply identifying with your anger? Later, when you had the time, did you study your experience and attempt to understand it? Where did that experience come from? How did you generate it? I don't know of any other way to awareness. You only change what you understand. What you do not understand and you are not aware of, you repress. You don't change. But when you understand it, it changes. I'm sometimes asked, is this growing in awareness a gradual thing or is it a whammo kind of thing? Well, there are some lucky people who see this in a flash. They just become aware. There are others who keep growing into it, slowly, gradually, increasingly. They begin to see things, and illusions drop away. Fantasies are peeled away, and they start to get in touch with the facts. There is no general rule. There's a famous story about a lion who came upon a flock of sheep, and to his amazement, he found a lion among the sheep. It was a lion who'd been brought up by the sheep ever since he was a cub. It would bleat like a sheep and run around like a sheep. The lion went straight for him, and when the sheep lion stood in front of the real one, he trembled in every limb. And the lion said to him, "What are you doing among these sheep?" And the sheep lion said, "I am a sheep." And the lion said, "Oh, no, you're not. You're coming with me." So he took the sheep lion to a pool, and he said, "Look." And when the sheep lion looked at his reflection in the water, he let out a mighty roar. And in that moment, he was transformed. He was never the same again. If you're lucky and the gods are gracious, or if you're gifted with divine grace, use any theological expression you want, you might suddenly understand who the I, in quotes, is. And if you understand your true nature, deeply, fully, you'll never be the same again. Nothing will ever be able to touch you again. And no one will ever be able to hurt you again. You will fear no one, and you will fear nothing. Isn't that extraordinary? You will live like a king, like a queen. That is what it means to live like royalty. Not the rubbish like getting your picture in the papers or having a lot of money. That's a lot of rot. You fear no one because you're perfectly content to be nobody. You don't give a damn about success or failure. They mean nothing. Honor, disgrace, they mean nothing. If you make a fool of yourself, that means nothing either. Isn't it a wonderful state to be in? Some people arrive at the goal painstakingly, step by step through months and weeks and years of self-awareness. But I will promise you this. I have not known a single person who gave time to being aware who didn't see a difference in a matter of weeks. The quality of their life changes. So they don't have to take it on faith anymore. They just see it. They feel it. They are different. They react differently. In fact, they react less and act more. Like the example I was just talking about with the car accident. I'm not reacting from the past. I'm just taking action in the moment based on what the truth of life in that moment calls me to do. When this happens, you're much more energetic. You're much more alive. Mistakenly, people think that if they had no cravings, they'd be like dead wood. But in fact, they would lose their tension. They would get rid of your fear of their fear, any fear of failure, any tension about will I succeed or not succeed. And you just act from the truth of life. It's the difference between just driving freely and driving with your brakes on. There's a saying from Tran Tzu, a great Chinese sage. He says, when the archer shoots for no particular prize, he has all his skills. When she shoots to win a brass buckle, she's already nervous. When she shoots for a gold prize, she goes blind. She sees two targets and she's out of her mind. Her skill has not changed, but the prize divides her. She cares. She thinks more of winning than of shooting. And the need to win drains her of power. Isn't that an image of what most people are? When you're living for nothing, you've got all your skills. When you live that way, you've got all your energy. You're relaxed. You don't care. It doesn't matter whether you win or lose. That's what life's about. That can only come from awareness. And in awareness, you'll understand that honor doesn't mean a thing. It's just a social convention, that's all. That's what the mystics and the prophets didn't bother with it one bit. Honor and disgrace meant nothing to them. They were living in another world, in the world of the awakened. Success or failure meant nothing to them. They had the attitude, I'm an ass, you're an ass, so where's the problem? Someone once said, the three most difficult things for a human being are not physical feats or intellectual achievements. They are the following. First, the most difficult thing for a human, first thing is to return love for hate. The second most difficult thing is to include the excluded. And the third most difficult thing is admitting you are wrong. However, all three of these things are the easiest things in the world if you haven't identified with the, quote, me, close quotes, with your thoughts about yourself and who and what you should be. You can easily say things like, I'm wrong. If you knew me better, you'd see how often I'm wrong. What would you expect from an ass? If I haven't identified with these aspects of me, you can't hurt me. Initially, the old conditioning will kick in, and you'll be depressed and anxious. You'll grieve, you'll cry, and so on. Before enlightenment, I used to be depressed. After enlightenment, I continue to be depressed. But there's a difference. I don't identify with it anymore. Just try to see what a huge difference that is. You step outside yourself and you look at the depression as an energy flowing through you, not who you and what you are. You don't do a thing to make it go away. You're perfectly willing to go on with your life while it passes through you and disappears. If you don't know what that means yet, you really have a lot to look forward to. And anxiety, there it comes. Oh, and you're not troubled. Oh, I have this anxious energy. You're anxious and you're not troubled by it. Isn't that a paradox? Are you willing to let this cloud come in? Because the more you fight it, the more power you give it. If you're willing to observe it as it passes by, you can be happy in your anxiety. Isn't that crazy? You can be, quote, happy, close quotes, in your depression. But you can't have the wrong notion of happiness. Happiness is not excitement or thrills. That's what causes depression. Didn't anybody ever tell you this? You're thrilled, all right, but just right now as you're thrilled, you're preparing for your next depression. Because now, as soon as you get thrilled, you get anxious. How can I make it last? What if it doesn't last? What if it's lost? That's not happiness. That's addiction. I wonder how many non-addicts are reading this book. If you're anything like the average group, there are very, very few. Please don't look down your nose at alcoholics and drug addicts. Maybe you're just as addicted as they are. The first time I got a glimpse of this new world, it was terrifying. I understood what it meant to be alone with nowhere to rest your head, to leave everyone free to be themselves and leave me free to be myself, to be special to no one, and to love or extend love to everyone, because love does that. Love shines on the good and the bad alike. It makes rain fall on saints and sinners alike. Is it possible for the rose to say, I'll give my fragrance to the good people who smell me, but I withhold it from the bad? Or is it possible for the lamp to say, I will give my light to the good people in this room, but I will withhold it from the evil people? These are images of what love is about. It's been there all along, staring us in the face in the scriptures, though we never cared to see it because we were so drowned in our culture and what our culture calls love. And all of the identifications with certain people that might bring us love. All of the love songs and poems, that isn't love at all. That's the opposite of love. That's desire and control and possessiveness. That's manipulation and fear and anxiety. It's not love. We were told that happiness is a smooth complexion, a holiday resort. But it isn't these things. And yet we have subtle ways of making our happiness depend on other things, both within us and outside of us. We say, I refuse to be happy until my neurosis goes. I have good news for you. You can be happy right now with the neurosis. You want even better news? There's only one reason why you're not experiencing what in India we call anand or bliss. There's only one reason you're not experiencing bliss at this present moment. And it's because you're thinking or focusing on what you don't have. Otherwise, you would be experiencing bliss. You're focusing on what you don't have. But right now, you have everything you need to be in bliss. Jesus was talking horse sense to lay people, to starving people, to poor people. He was telling them good news. It's yours for the taking. But who listens? No one's interested. They'd rather be asleep. So again, we're reading from the book Awareness by Anthony DeMello. And the next section is titled Fear, the Root of Violence. And he says, some say there are only two things in the world, God and fear. Love and fear are the only two things. There's only one evil in the world, fear. There's only one good in the world, love. It's sometimes called by other names. It's sometimes called happiness or freedom or peace or joy or God or light or love or spirit, whatever. The label doesn't really matter. There's not a single evil in the world that you cannot trace to fear, not one. Ignorance and fear, ignorance caused by fear, that's where all the evil comes from. That's where your violence comes from. The person who is truly nonviolent, who is incapable of violence, is the person who is fearless. It's only when you're afraid that you become angry. Think of the last time you were angry. Go ahead. Think of the last time you were angry and search your mind for the fear behind it. What were you afraid of losing? What were you afraid would be taken from you? That's where the anger comes from. Think of an angry person, maybe someone you're afraid of. Can you see how frightened he or she is? She's really frightened. Really, she is. She's really frightened or she wouldn't be angry. Ultimately, there are only two things, either love or fear. In this retreat, I'd rather leave it like this, unstructured and moving from one thing to another, returning to themes again and again, because that's the way to really grasp what's being said here. And if it doesn't hit you the first time, it might the second or the fifth or the 37th. And what doesn't hit one person might hit another. I've got different themes, but they're all about the same thing. Call it awareness, call it love, call it spirituality, call it freedom or awakening or whatever. It's really all the same thing. The day before yesterday in Michael's half of the show, it's exactly what he was talking about. He said, I'm going to say things over and over and over again because we need to hear them over and over again. The first part of hearing something over and over and over again is being able to question what I already think I know. The next part of it is being able to see with new eyes what in the New Testament they would call metanoia, a new mind, a completely new mind. Well, if I know what I know, and I know how I know it, and when I learned it, and all there is to know about it, I am not open to learning anything new. If I'm willing to start living in the question, I open myself up to infinite possibilities in that moment. Why do we do all the repetition? Why do we keep saying the same thing over and over again? because maybe the next time the person who hears it is going to have an opening in their defenses, and they'll be able to hear it in a new way and start to apply it in their own life and observe directly for themselves. Area code 203, you're in the air. Who do we have and how can we support you?
Hi, I'm not sure if you take calls to help people that have certain situations they're struggling with.
We do that through the format of the work we teach. It's not, you know, psychic work, but it is the reality management worksheet. And so are you asking about the work that we do here with Ancient Aramaic Forgiveness and the tools?
I'm not sure. I'm not looking for a psychic reading.
So what is it we can help you with?
I'm considering and supposedly going to be baptized this weekend. I'm new to this, and I have some hesitancy, but that's all that I can deal with. But I'm also wondering if it's the right time to go through with it. Oh, sorry. I'm just incredibly heartbroken as I'm being shut out by my daughter-in-law from seeing my granddaughter. So I'm really wondering if this is maybe not the best time to do it.
Well, in this work, we would encourage you to take a nice deep breath, hold it at the top, and slow the exhale down. So you extend your exhale as much as you can.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll feel your emotions even more, but you will keep moving them through you if you can just breathe. And we have a whole host of tools that might help you. And they're all available for free.
Okay.
So if you just start breathing, and what I'm hearing you say is, your question is, should I go through with having a baptism at a time when I'm going through all kinds of emotional turmoil?
Yeah, because I'm just so, you know, really withdrawn, you know, not that present.
Well, there's no way for me to address for you individually whether or not a baptism would be a good thing or an off-the-mark thing. And yet, we have a whole host of tools that we recommend for people absolutely free to help them dismantle their negative emotional states. And we recommend that you do that before you make your decisions. Because if you make the decision when you have a negative emotional state up in your mind,
right,
you're not going to be as happy with the results as if you dismantle that upset first.
Okay. So I clicked on something on your blog talk page, and there's blue squares. Is that what you're talking about, where I can find the tools?
I don't know, but I would direct you to two different websites. One of them is the whyagain.org website, and you might be on that one.
I am.
Okay. If you click on the words that say start here from that page in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can get access to Dr. Michael Rice's chapter 24 of his book. The book is titled Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And you can read that chapter of that book. You can, where he explains and describes in a narrative format the reality management worksheet, which is the core tool in this work. And it's a tool for changing what I'm doing with my mind energy that's generating my negative emotions. It's the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible set of tools I've learned in my now 50 years of doing therapy. And it's available absolutely free. You can actually download the worksheet process itself. And you can also download a host of audio files of shows like this one where people have been stepped through that worksheet process. And just two or three of those can serve as a tutorial for you to teach you how to use the worksheet process yourself.
Okay.
There's also another website that I would point you to. It's called mindshiftersacademy.org. And on mindshiftersacademy.org, there's a whole host of audio files of shows like this one. There's a short version of that reality management worksheet, which is what I use in my private practice with people to introduce them to the worksheet process. On the educational materials page on that website, you can download the short mental version of the worksheet process and all kinds of other good stuff there. Now, I want to mention before I forget this that absolutely free, if you have access to the internet, you could join us tonight through the internet for a support group that runs from 6:30 to 9 p.m. Central Time. And we would have time there to actually step you through the worksheet process or explain it to you if you try doing it between now and then and you're having any difficulty. And those support groups have been running for, at the end of August this year, one of them is going to have been running for 20 years, meeting on Tuesday nights from 6:30 to 9 p.m. And that's how powerful and effective those tools are that I've been donating my time to that every Tuesday night for the past 20 years.
Okay. I'm interested in that. Also, MindShifters is not coming up. I've tried three times.
Okay.
MindShifters.
Academy.org.
Right. Right. MindShifters with an S.
MindShifters with an S on the end, academy.org.
Okay, now I've got it. Thank you.
And the educational materials page is the one that has the mental short version of that worksheet. That's what I use in my private practice to introduce people to this process. The next thing is, you're talking about an estrangement with someone in your family.
Yeah.
Right? And lots of upset around that. So if you go to the MindShifters Academy page and find the little magnifying glass that lets you search.
Right.
Search for the word Pierre.
P-I-E-R-R-E?
Yes.
Okay. Pierre, heard of an interview. Okay.
If you click on that, it will let you download the interview that I did with Pierre Pratervand, where he talks about his book, The Gentle Art of Blessing, and the book has a very powerful process. Since what we understand in this work is that I can't change other people. I can't make somebody want to let me have access to them or reengage in a relationship, et cetera. But I do have the ability to change what I'm doing with my mind energy.
Right.
And I can do this practice that Pierre writes about, and it came to him in a flash and a flooding and has been a very powerful technique for changing my personal energy to the positive in situations that aren't what I really want.
Right.
Whether it's somebody estranging themselves from me or somebody dying or somebody getting really, really sick, et cetera.
Yeah.
And that's where I would start you in listening to that interview, because it's a really good intro to his books. And you can get a sense of how powerful that process is and actually just start doing it just from listening to that interview.
I'm having a hard time finding it. I just came up to a bunch of audio library, but
Okay, but did you just click on the page where it says Pierre? There's a link on that page that takes you, it loads up a page where all that's on it is Pierre's interview.
I've got Pierre, his interview. It says find out more about him at Gentle
Right, but,
Art
but
of
there
Life.
Should be a little audio link to just click and start listening to the audio file.
There, I don't see one. It's that, and then best of audio files, but there's nothing to link. Like, okay, so now I'm on best of audio files 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, you know, I don't know which one. Let's see. Bottom one is Pierre Pradovan interview for 2019. Is that it?
Probably it.
Okay. That's the only one I see with his name. All right. I'll listen to that. Thank you. Yeah, I'm interested tonight. How do I find your group?
On that same MindShifters page, there's one page for the information for Thursday's support group and a different page for Tuesday's support group.
Okay, got it. Thursday online group info. Okay. So I just joined that Zoom meeting?
Yep, 6:30 Central Time. And did you give us a first name here?
My name's Pat.
Pat?
Yeah, I don't know how to join the Zoom meeting.
Okay, well, if you have access, you don't need to do anything about money or registering anything. All you have to do is on that web page where it says the Zoom information, add that to a, you know, like if you go to zoom.com and say, I want to attend a meeting, that's the number that you need.
Great. I got it. Thank you. That'll work.
All right. So now, so we don't lose contact, now you have the MindShiftersAcademy.org website.
Right.
You can send me an email through that website.
Okay.
Or you can email me at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org.
Hang on a minute. tjh at
mindshifters-academy.org.
Okay, thank you.
So if there's any difficulty getting on the group tonight, you can send me an email. And this, you know, the web page says, here's the, you join the Zoom meeting and it's, you know, you just type in this 9-digit number, 514-407.
Right.
019. You type that into, you know, the Zoom, and Zoom's a free program, right? You just go to zoom.com and say join a meeting and type in that number and you'll be able to join us at 6:30.
Okay. It's TJH at MindShifter, not an S after it, right?
Say that again. It's TJH at MindShifters
-academy.org. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
And keep breathing.
Yeah.
And if you're able to join us, I look forward to supporting you even more tonight in the group.
Thank you so much. And what time
welcome.
Does it start again?
And it's 6:30 Central Time.
Central, okay. All right, thank you so much. What, you're in Central right now? What time are you?
11:49 10 minutes to noon.
All right. Great.
Where are you?
Thank you so much. I'm Eastern, so for me it's 12:49.
Okay.
Right now. Okay, thank you so much.
We have a number of people that, you know, have off and on joined us from Eastern time, but some find it's too late. But if you can join us and give us the time to support you, I'd be happy to give you the introduction to these tools and any support you need to make them useful for you.
I appreciate it. I'm glad I called. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Pat. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
So any comments or questions? And we've got about 9 minutes left, or I can just start the second hour since they're in the Michael and Jeannie are otherwise occupied. And our second half today will be Aramaicisms Part 4. So going once, going twice, going three times, 563-999-3581. If you have a comment or a question about what we've talked about so far, or the call from Pat, or something else before we start our second hour, let us know. Before Pat called, I was reading from Anthony DeMello's work. Area code 360, you're in the air. Who do we have and how can we support you?
Hi, Dr. Tim. This is Julia, and I just wanted to say thank you for all the support, and I love everything that you do and read to us, and it's very helpful for me in my life, and I recently purchased Anthony DeMello audio book, and it's really fun to listen to him. He has a great laugh and has good funny jokes, and so I'm really enjoying that. So thank you for bringing that to my awareness, and that's what I wanted to do, is just say thank you and just really appreciate you with all my heart.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, and you're welcome and deserving. And if you bought the book Awareness on audio, it is different than the Kindle version or the paperback version. It's literally recordings pieced together from his seminars or retreats. And I agree with you. It's quite entertaining. You can hear his joking laughter and his sarcasm and his, you know, joking on himself. So
I kind of noticed that if you're reading the book. Yeah, I noticed that. Like, it, some person will say chapter 7, and it sounds like, you know, just somebody kind of put these recordings together. And at home, this guy sounds when he comes on, and it also sounds, you know, like it's a lot of different lectures. And I thought of Susan Bingham when he talks about politicians and how he just says they're all insane, they're just insane, and then just laughs. And I got a kick out of that. I thought, oh, Susan should listen to this. And, you know, because really you can really tell, like, yeah, they are, aren't they? This whole world system is just insane. And everybody's asleep. And, I mean, there are some people that aren't asleep or in the process of waking up. I would consider myself hopefully in the process of waking up. And, but, yeah, I really enjoy it. Thanks for letting me know that it's different than the Kindle version. And does he have, like, a – probably has a hardback or a, not a hardback, but a soft cover.
I have it in paperback, yes. And he was born in 1931 and died in 1987. So a lot of this stuff, you know, like the audio file and everything, is just reconstructed after the fact.
Yeah.
The book – you know, Awareness came out in 1990, but he died in 87. So someone compiled this from his writings. He has other books that, you know, from 1982, et cetera. He was writing, but he died young.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, I'm really enjoying it.
Well, it's a gem. It's been a gem for me for years, even before I found the audio file, the Audible version. And I've been reading and rereading it every other year or every year or so for quite a while. So I'm glad you're resonating with it, and I'm glad you're enjoying the work we're doing on the show.
Yes, and since we have like two more minutes or so, I also wanted to mention that this past week, what hit me differently was when you were talking about how in the Way of Mastery, when it says that we create our life, it's how we react to what we're experiencing is the creation of our life, right? And I was more thinking like, oh, it's my thoughts that are making it happen, right? And so it was like I was kind of putting it before, but it's kind of reverse. I don't know if I'm explaining that correctly, but it's like once you're having the experience, that's what's creating your life and your experience, right? Because it's only now. You can only be in the present moment. And so we think that, oh, if I sit here and visualize Mercedes coming, right? But it's kind of like, you know, do you need the Mercedes or like you don't need a Mercedes? It's, you know, I'm happy where I am now and I feel fulfilled and I feel abundant. And so then I'm abundant and I don't really need a Mercedes. So in my present moment, how I'm feeling and responding is how I'm creating my life.
Well, absolutely. And Guy Finley says, you know, all these people talk about this manifesting stuff, and he has a perspective that's very much like the Way of Mastery. What Way of Mastery says about the manifesting stuff is it says, look, it's not a secret and it's not new. It's what you've been doing your whole life. And while it can be, you know, a useful exercise to try manifesting a Mercedes or something else, Way of Mastery says the problem with that is that you can only manifest what your brain has been trained to believe would be good things to manifest. And so Guy Finley says, I'll give you something to manifest that's new and different than you've ever thought of before. And it's better than anything else you could manifest. Manifest a way to be happy with whatever you've got right now.
Yep. I love that.
And that's exactly what Abraham would say. There's really good research. Buddha's brain and books like that talk about how whatever we think we're going to enjoy, whatever enjoyment we're going to get out of the Mercedes that we buy or the new house or the fabulous romance we're going to have, the vast majority of pleasure and enjoyment we're going to get out of those things, we experience before we get them.
Yeah.
By this fantasy of how it's going to be.
Yeah, before you get it, you don't have to pay the car insurance. You don't have to pay for, like, oh, the brakes. I have to repair the brakes every 2 years, right? You know, it's like all this maintenance
but
someone keys it. Or
that and the idea that there's the old adage that the shine wears off the rose pretty quickly, right? So the new boyfriend or girlfriend is wonderful until they say or do something that steps on your bag of garbage, and then it's not so wonderful anymore. Or, you know, the great, the fabulous, the wonderful ways that we kiss and hug and hold hands and have sex is great, but now it's kind of boring. We're doing the same position every night. It's that kind of a thing that our mind creates all of this wonderful experience, in the fantasy of the thing before it happens, and that's the vast majority of enjoyment we're going to get out of the thing. And that's what we're coached into in this work. Find a way to be happy and then generate that feeling that you think you're going to have when you go after something. And then if you still want it, go get it. But now, once you get it, you don't have to be afraid of losing it because you know you can be happy even without it. If you can't be happy until you get the thing, then as soon as you get it, now the thing that you just got is the source of your fear. What if you lose it? And there goes your happiness. So it's all backwards if you try to make something outside of you change your emotional state. But all of this work is about going inside and figuring out how we are changing our emotional state, whether we realize it or not, to generate our negativity and our pain and our fear and our sadness, or our joy, our aliveness, our gratitude, etc. So I thank you so much for the call. I will mute you so you can listen to the second hour if you so desire. Our second hour today is the fourth hour of Aramaicisms. Jeannie asked me to play that because Michael's not available today. And so I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. This is your second hour.
Ruka the Kutcha. You want to talk about kosher?
Sure. Well, you know, first of all, kudsha, anybody ever heard the word kosher? Comes from this right here. If you look at that in the scholarly sense, what it actually, the word kudsha means is intended for mankind, something that is holistic and whole for mankind. If you look at it just literally as its root sounds, it literally means whole, all-encompassing, all-embracing. This here is the word Holy Spirit. First of all, I mentioned last night a lot about spirit, about how it was more accurately breath in Aramaic and how breath and spirit were not two separate things back then. That happened when Latin spread itself out across the kingdom, and then all of a sudden you had breath and you had spirit. Now today we're looking for spirit, and we're looking for spiritual things, not realizing that what we're looking for is what is looking. And the greatest way to connect with spirit is, and I said yesterday, if you want to understand Yeshua's teachings better in the first century Aramaic perspective, cross out the word spirit and write breath above it. Sounds very Buddhist almost. That's going to give you a much more accurate understanding. The idea of an outside or somehow disembodied spirit that we can't see would have been such a foreign concept that if he were to talk like that, nobody would even know what he was talking about. Not that everybody understood what he was talking about anyway. So this Rucha here is, that's that word for breath, spirit, energy. It would be pneuma in the Greek, spiritus in the Latin. An elemental force. This is Rucha right here, okay? Now, intriguingly, the word's Rucha. So technically, that means this. Rucha is not technically the force, but rather our experience of it. That's what Rucha is. And I said yesterday that in the first century Aramaic understanding, being feminine, what I feel on my arm is not breath in the way that we think of it. What I feel on my arm is just hot air. Breath in Aramaic, in ancient Aramaic, was not the hot air that moves through my body, but rather my feminine experience of its movement. Everybody breathing right now? I can feel like a... That's a lot different, isn't it? Yeshua wasn't pointing to things and saying, do this and don't do that, and look at that word and that word, and walk this and walk that there, and do that there and that right there. He was talking about coming back to the eye within the eye, and realizing that you can actually answer the question, are you breathing or are you being breathed? Rucha breathes you. When you get your breath moving and you allow your temple to open, she, which is what she was called in the first century, someone can just flippantly in the middle of a conversation say she, and people would know they were talking about the Holy Spirit. Rucha the Kudsha, the all-embracing breath of God. And there's a lot of amazing power in this is the word of, this is a little prefix, the Dalit, which essentially means of, you could put it that way. Interesting. And if you can just be aware of your breath and understand the only reason you can't breathe in any moment is because things are up and resonating. And if you don't know how to forgive, you're never going to be able to open your temple, ever, because there's always going to be residue there. There's always going to be junk that's going to keep that from happening.
And it's interesting when he's talking to Nicodemus about this.
Mm.
Nicodemus doesn't have a clue what he's talking about.
The leader of the Jews.
This is it. And Yeshua says, what? You a leader? You don't understand this? And then notice what he defaults to. He then explains to him an elemental force. This word is used to describe all of the elemental forces. And in particular, there's one for humans, but he gives Nicodemus the example of this elemental force called the wind. And he says, you know it came from somewhere, and you know it went somewhere, but you don't know it directly. You can only know it by the effects that it creates. And so in each of us, there is this elemental force for that which is proper for humans. And if you turn yourself over to that energetic flow in you, then that power will process those things out of your structure. Ruka Dekudsha. We could say in our modern language almost a super processor. Nicodemus wasn't aware of the super processor. And it's interesting to watch how the Greek fear-based translations can turn things so backward. So we hear about this, and over the years I've worked with so many people who, I remember one man who was in his 70s, and he was starting to look at, thinking about, you know, my lifetime is getting short, and he was sure that he was going to hell for eternity. Because as a young man, as a teenager, he did what he considered to be the denial of the Holy Spirit. And he was sure that that's where he was going to burn for eternity. And there's nothing in the Aramaic about the denial of the Holy Spirit is the unforgivable sin, or the denial of the force for that which is proper. What it says is, in essence, let's kind of do a long form of it. In your carbon-based memory system, your body's structure is made of carbon, 6 electrons, 6 protons, 6 neutrons, and anything that's put in there that doesn't belong there is stored holographically in every cell and passed from generation to generation. So we've got 4 generations, we're told, in there. That's 31 lives. If you've got 31 lives in there, and then remember again last night, we talked about 10,000 brain cells firing, 9 bits of data can come to conscious awareness in these pictures that we paint behind our eyeballs. How long do you suppose, if there's a pattern in your family system, it's going to take you processing 9 bits of data at a time to get through it? Not likely to happen anytime soon. What that passage says is being explained is that you have a power in you that if you invite her into activity in you, she will process you right down to your genetic toes. The denial of that power will leave you in unforgiveness. You won't have the capacity to process that much information. It isn't unforgivable. There's nothing like that. But if you're not able to call that power into play in you, if you can't acknowledge that it's there and invite it into activity, then you're on your own. And on your own, it's a pretty stuck place to be.
It doesn't work.
It doesn't work. But there is literally an elemental force in each of us that if we call it into activity, and you know, when it always amazes me when I watch people do the forgiveness worksheet process from Why Is This Happening to Me Again? So often somebody starts that worksheet out and there's this big, messy, you know, arms going in every which way, hate, fear, anger, rage, guilt, grief. And literally 4 minutes after they do the forgiveness process, they're like, well, why was that such a big deal? And where did it go? And it's gone. Probably the most common comment that I get from people, I don't know if you've done this when you've done the worksheet with people,
But when I ask people, how do you feel after you've done the forgiveness process compared to before? And before, it's all these emotions and all this stuff. And literally 4 minutes later, it's, you know, it's silly that I ever had any disturbance about that. And the truth is, you've never had any disturbance about anything. You've just been disturbed. Your mind can put it anywhere. When you enter into forgiveness and you call on that force for that which is proper, that force for that which is proper can take a lifetime of trauma in 35 seconds or less and disappear it. Don't quote me, is that some kind of literal number? Just disappear it. And on the other side of it, people are laughing at something that they were extremely traumatized about just minutes ago. But you can't do that on your own. Our own pea brain can't do that level of process work. And so when I can acknowledge that power is in me and can move through me and undo what doesn't belong, untie me or liberate me from those things, everything changes.
Oh, yeah. It fits right in with it. So, You know, it's amazing. The Nicodemus thing is funny. He came under the cover of night with his, well, it didn't say with his tail between his legs. You know, the leader of the Jews saying, I heard you're some sort of a big deal and I wanted to come and talk to you. But it's intriguing how when he says the wind comes and goes, you don't know where it's coming from or where it's going to, that word's rucha. And then it says, as it is with spirit. What hand gesture, wind, he can go like this. What hand gesture would he have to make for spirit? You know, what would he have to do? Foreign concept in the first century. He would have probably gone, as it is with rucha, as in breath. Remember, breath and spirit were artificially separated later, not yet. Okay? He probably would have gone, and he also says, of course, you must be reborn of maya and rucha, maya as in water. But intriguingly, that word maya, what it really means is great flowing expanse. It's at the end of shemaya, which is the word heaven. Must be reborn of the all and its movement, its elemental forces. And, you know, there's another thing that's hooked on so often that I get asked about. People say, all right, but what about born again? What does it say in Aramaic? And what I would also say to a biblical scholar is, what does it say in Greek? So, interesting. That phrase in Aramaic, another thing he said in John 3 to Nicodemus, is that you must be metelid man darish. Okay? What does that mean? That word rish or resh means head. Now let me explain what head means, okay? It doesn't mean this. People can say born of the crown chakra. That's nice. It could be that. It could be part of it. This was called the Christ chakra in Gnosticism, okay? That's a good one. That makes sense. But let's look. As a matter of fact, that's what Christos means, open channel of divinity. Now here's head. In the Gospel of Thomas, not allowed in the Bible, in the Gospel of Thomas, and I will say Thomas is not a person, Thomas is Tumas, which in Aramaic means twin, meaning this is a reflection of the fundamental guy that's been kind of shown for the last couple of decades. Okay, we're showing a reflection. If you're at the head of a line, where are you? The beginning, right? Or we naturally say beginning first. There's another head on a line. The end. The first shall be last, the last shall be first. I am projected into this world and not of it. Now let me explain head to you. First of all, the head means the beginning. It's the beginning of a cosmic expansion. Okay? The head, as an example, what they asked you, him in the Gospel of Thomas, they said, can you tell us how our end will come? And although it doesn't say chuckle, I assume he probably chuckled and said, okay, have you actually found the beginning that now you're looking for the end? And he said, blessed is the one who takes his place in the beginning at the head. For he will know the end, or the head, or leading edge, and he will not taste death. Remember, he came to crucify the world, the cosmos, Alma. He came to crucify our belief in time and space, and inside and out, and light and dark, and positive and negative. These are all qualities of a singular continuum. They are not anything that is separate, because if you take one away, the other is gone. Okay? And there's actually a word I'd like to share with you. Bereshit. This is the first word of the Torah. It's the first word of the Torah. It's also the beginning of the Gospel of John. One thing a lot of people don't realize is that this is to expand on the idea of the head, the beginning and the end. A lot of people don't realize that the original Hebrew Torah, which of course begins in Genesis, Bereshit, with "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth," even higher than 30, 913 clear and distinctly separate ways that you can translate that from Hebrew into English or Hebrew into Greek. Interesting. Not many people realize that this is it in Hebrew, this is it in Aramaic. Same pronunciation. Most people don't realize that the original Hebrew Torah was not words and verses and phrases. That came hundreds of years later. It was actually a string of characters like a mathematical algorithm or a constant like pi. Okay? And it wasn't broken down into the metaphorical storyline of in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth and Adam and Eve and snakes and Cain and Abel and all this other stuff until hundreds of years, possibly over 1,000 years later. Okay? Because it was just a string of characters. And they didn't read the characters. They toned the characters. They still tone them to this day. Okay? Now, what's amazing about Semitic languages is each letter has a meaning. And it's amazing that the very deep nuance of Genesis is unpacked by the realization that what they would do is they would tone each letter individually unto itself, but the gist was much like Georges Seurat or a pointillism painting. When you're in close, you see smashes of paint, and you get so obsessive about detail, but the key is being able to pull back and holistically see the whole. So they would tone each letter and also be in that flow and be able to, as much as possible, take in the fullest nuance of the text. Now, this is something that's going to unpack the inside-outside beginning and being reborn from the head thing a lot better than you could even imagine that it is. There's a reason why it's at the beginning, and I really think the Gospel of John should have been at the beginning of the canonical Gospels, but of course they put Matthew there because it had all the begatting. The funny thing about all the begatting is they're showing you Jesus' bloodline, right? Right? Who's his father? God. Does he have a bloodline? That's number one. Number two, who's right before Jesus in the bloodline? Joseph, his stepfather. They're not showing you Jesus' bloodline. They're showing you Joseph's stepfather. Hello, McFly. Pick one, y'all. Stick to the story. You go to Luke, they do the same thing, but they do it in reverse, and it goes Jesus to Joseph and goes all the way from Adam to God. It's not his bloodline. That's an example of a secret, something that's right under your nose that you've seen 1,000 times, but you never thought about before. There's a lot of that stuff. Now, Beit Resh Aleph Shin Yod Tal, okay? That's what we've got here. Bereshit. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to show you very simple process of the letter meanings of each of these letters, okay? And this is just one word we're going to do it with, all right? So I'm going to ask you to just pay attention for just a couple of minutes. It's not going to take long. Now, the first one is bet or bet. When you know in the beginning, in the is the word bet or bait, okay? Now, I'm going to have to erase this. Michael knows I get all excited and passionate about this stuff. He doesn't get excited and passionate, though. Yes, he does. There we go. Woohoo! You trying to erase me? Now, this is what the letter Beit means, okay? And intriguingly, Beit or Beata, it's also a word in Latin. It means this. It means house, okay? Now, this in Proto-Sinaitic, the earliest style of writing that we have, Beit means house. It still does to this day. And it looks like this. It looked like a house. But let me explain something to you. House, Beit, when you know Beit Lachem, Bethlehem, the house of bread. Okay? Interesting. House, Beit, doesn't mean just a building with bricks and structures and walls. Take a breath. What it means is it's the differentiation between the inside and the outside. The object of my attention appears to have an inside and an outside, light, dark, positive, negative, masculine, feminine. It also means burst open. It's the root of the word blessing. Okay, and I said yesterday, it says that we were born as the original blessing of life itself. Okay? So we've got burst open as its own blessing from inside to its outside. All right? The next letter is resh. Resh is the word head. It means leading edge, or it means source or leading edge. Head, okay? You know what's amazing? The original letter looks like this. It was a neck with a head on it. Interesting. So, next letter is Aleph. Aleph is actually the first letter, well, rather than writing the letter, is actually the first letter of the Hebrew and Aramaic alphabets, and it sounds like this. Listen closely, okay? It doesn't have a sound, technically. It is often pronounced like this, though. Ah, ah, okay? Now, this aleph is put in words to keep a word in motion. Part of it, there's a symbolic depth to it, which I'm going to get to, but it's not the same as having a space there, even if it's not spoken. But the difference is that you keep it moving, okay? You stay in motion. Now, what aleph meant was ox. Wow, that's the key to the cosmos, is ox. Huh? The original letter looked like this, okay? This was the original letter for aleph. What does that look like? It looks like an ox. Why? Because then and now, the ox was considered to be an animal in agrarian societies, agricultural societies, that was so tremendously powerful because it didn't just have strong haunches or shoulders or back or legs, but rather that it gained its tremendous strength only when it was in a state of absolute wholeness. Strength only comes when we are holistic and whole. That's where power comes from. That's where all power comes from. That was represented by the sound ah, which was aleph, which is everything. It's the whole ball game. You getting what I'm saying? And then we've got the letter shin, or sheen. Now, what's interesting about this one, I'm just going to put it below. It looked like this. This is literally the original letter. It meant shine, sheen, or express. It was a lip with teeth underneath it. We're going back about 8,000 to 10,000 years right now, okay? It means shine, sheen, or express. Whoa. The next letter was yod, which means hand. When it says in the Gospel of John, nothing existed except through his hands, beyada, ada, or yeda in Aramaic, that doesn't mean that God's got a workbench up there and he's building the world. What it means is everything you see is God. There's no outside God. There's no outside presence. There's no all-powerful anything except that which you have not opened up your awareness to. Okay? But that yod means to reach out. It means to reach out. The original letter looked like this. It was an arm with fingers on the end of it, a hand, and it meant reach out. And then the last letter looked like this. Just two lines next to each other. That word means reflection or echo of itself. Now, if you just look at the word Bereshit, and then I'm going to turn this back to Michael, this is just the first word of the Bible, okay? You've got Reshit, which is a woven net that a fisherman would use, and the Reshit, or Reshit, it would be squeezed down, and they would throw it, and it would go like this. Reshit, that's what Reshit means, the casting out of a net. Okay? In the middle is Resh, which means head, or leading edge. Reshi literally means at the leading edge of the rushing headwaters. Kind of like you're going down a mountain stream and you're surfing the leading edge of the cosmos. You ever have that feeling when you're so fully, wholly present right now in this moment at your center that you feel as if you're at the leading edge of all creation? That's what it means to be born again. Literally, looking at this word, there's also Ash or Esh, which is an expanding fire, bursting open as its own blessing from the head or leading edge of everything to shine, sheen, express, and reach out to become its own reflection. That's just the first word of the Bible. Do you think maybe we missed something? That's what wholeness means. You get it? Oh, I got the vapors.
And you can't figure it out.
Yeah, your brain can't hold it. Forget it.
You got to be in the energy of it. You're triggering me the memory of something that Carl Jung said that I think was so powerful. And he says, who looks without, and of course, looking without means you paint a picture on the inside of your eyeballs and you think you're looking at something out there. Who looks without dreams, who looks within awakens. And when you start looking within, when you let this take you within, when you let your breath take you within, then everything is transformed. Everything changes. And there comes a space for wholeness into this expression. Pretty cool. And you can't do it by keeping your attention on what's in your brain. You actually have to ultimately repent. Does that mean you have to proclaim yourself a worthless sinner and a...
Repent!
Sorry. Go ahead.
No, I don't want to do it.
So it means to turn another way. You look at people who are looking without, as Carl Jung said, we think it's out there, and we're in a dream. We're stuck. We're lost in a dream. And you want to turn your vision 180 degrees in the other direction. To look within and see that the source of the world that you live in, the source of the construct, for those who weren't here yesterday, we quoted from a CIA website where they're working to understand how to get the best perception possible from their analysts to get the best intelligence possible. And what they literally say is that we do not record reality, we construct reality. And every reality that you see through your body's eyes is painted on the inside of your eyeballs from what's moving inside of you. If you never get beyond what's painted on the inside of your eyeballs, then you'll live forever in a dream. And the horror, the dream of the world is, somebody else did this to me, and therefore I'm hopeless, I'm helpless, there's nothing I can do. When you give up looking without at the dream and you repent, you turn in another direction, you awaken from the dream because you're now directly in touch with the root of the dream. You bring your human life, the active presence of love and the breath to the dream, and the dream starts to dissolve. Then you get a set of directions that comes from a different place. You know, we spoke yesterday about the Creator. They say the Creator is omnipresent. If the Creator is omnipresent, is in every corner of the universe, there's that active presence of love. And the physicists, as we said yesterday, tell us that every molecule in the universe is in continuous communication with every molecule in the universe. Is it possible that when we can collapse our preoccupation, that is, forgive our preoccupation with what's out there, drop within and remove it, then we move into whole field perception, where we are literally guided by these energy forces that come from the Creator through the whole creation, and therefore we are, our structure, our realities are structured out of literally the energy field of the Creator, the mind of the Creator, rather than the mind of your body. When you move there, you get to live in the present. And the reason they call it a present is because whenever you're there, there's a gift, there's a present. And it is that active presence of love that will clean up everything in your structure that never belonged there. Thoughts?
Just one little piece, literally. Just two little pieces then, okay? You know, one of the things that I had a dear friend, this is going back in the early 90s, his name was Michael Talbot. We lost Michael to leukemia, a really rare form of leukemia. I had such an amazing relationship with him. He lived up in New York City. He had a book that he wrote called The Holographic Universe. And one of the things about Michael is he did lots of research into the holographic nature of reality, which, of course, has been something that's been out there for probably a 100 years really fully formed on one level or another. But it's an amazing thing that if you take a whole holographic plate that has a three-dimensional image in it,
And this is an actual true laser hologram. A laser hologram, you can aim the laser in and actually encode the information in that holographic plate. And if you give just the slightest degree of shift, you can put another whole full image and another one and another and another, another, like these infinite dimensions, the mansions of many mansions that we live in right now. All of these infinite images can be shown in this laser plate. And you shine the laser in at whatever angle it is, and you'll see the one that went in at that degree. What's most beautiful about this is if you take a holographic plate and you drop it, and it shatters into thousands of pieces on the ground, and you shine a laser into every single sliver and splinter that it broke into, you can put it at the exact same angle and see all of those images wholly and holistically in their entirety on each sliver. But there does become a point when the slivers or the breaks become small enough that the laser will no longer be able to perceive the image of holism anymore. There's a point when that doesn't mean it's not there, but it's almost impossible to perceive anymore in the world and locked in it.
Separateness.
Exactly. And that brings me to the second point, which is this. John 3:16, let me just say it clearly without going into all the studies there are that it was actually a right-hand marginal note that was integrated into a copy of it. The Gospel of John, Yohanan, was originally called the Gospel of the Beloved Disciple. John 3:16, everybody, you see it all the time. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever shall believeth in him shall not perish, but shall have everlasting or eternal life. And I just would love to just get this one thing out there very briefly, and I'll show it to you in English. Okay? This is the word in Aramaic. Yehudaya. Yehudaya or echadaya. This is the word in Greek. Monogones. Now, what does mono mean? One. What does gones mean? Birth, born. Only born, only begotten. Now here's an interesting thing, okay? Does anybody know when monogones was defined as only begotten in John 3:16? We know the exact year that it was given its definition. Monogenes was already in the text of the Gospel of John. They didn't define it until the 4th century in 325 AD at the Council of Nicaea. And they picked four possible definitions and they chose one out of a hat. The one that they chose was only begotten, and Constantine was very clear that the reason they chose it was because Horus was known as only begotten in ancient Egypt, and he knew people would eat the story that much easier. It's not a secret. Research it. Interesting. You know what it means in Aramaic? Yah means who. It's a point back to Yahweh, the oneness, the wholeness. It doesn't mean who as in yoo-hoo, person, but rather the I within the I, the who behind the who. Okay? Chud in Aramaic is literally the word one. It's the word one in Aramaic. It's the number one. Okay? Ayah. It's an interesting word because it's in many languages. And what ayah means is something that has no beginning and no ending, much like a vine. Something that is growing, 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 and it's one with everything. It's always in a process of oneness. It's always in a process. On one level, it's on a process of oneness. On another level, it's in a process, you know, in what seems to be the physical world of constant growth. It never stops expanding. Yehudaya, one who is absolutely single and one with everything. There's no such thing as a begotten in it. There is no begotten. Because begotten implies what? Two. There's no two in the word. It actually says one. Intriguing. Think of the pain and the torture and the suffering that's been done in the name of John 3:16 because people think other people don't get it, when, bless their hearts, even ministers who have been in the pulpit for 6 or 7 decades of their life and they've gone to the theological institutions and they've got all the numbers and letters behind their name, they don't even know the history of their own religion. I say that with absolute love and peace.
time for us to wake up, because ignorance is not bliss. Ignorance is blindness. And believe it or not, you're the only game in town, because there's only one.
Okay, let's look at the opening words in the book of John. We're told that it says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word became flesh. In Aramaic, it's something much more profound than just speaking a word. There are a couple of different ways to translate it, and one of them is mind energy, and the other one is willed action. And when you think about that, and then, you know, so often now today, we get the benefit of the world of physics and the world of physiology and research that goes into the science of it, and it all starts to make sense. Now, there's a video that we carry with an interview with a fellow named Bruce Lipton, who's a cell biologist. And when I first was introduced to Bruce, it was after I'd done a television interview up in New York, and this gentleman said, are you familiar with Bruce Lipton? This is back 20 years ago, before Bruce was very popular. I said, no. And he says, well, he's a cell biologist, and he's doing the same work you are. It's like, really, a cell biologist doing what I'm doing? And he handed me his video, said, here, watch this. And I was just amazed at what unfolded. And one of the main things that Bruce talks about on that particular video is that when you think a thought, that thought becomes a molecule in your structure. Actually, Deepak Chopra speaks about that action as the non-physical becoming physical. Mind energy becomes flesh. Willed action becomes flesh. And so what he's showing is that you think a thought, and that thought becomes a molecule. The molecule circulates around in your structure until it finds a cell with a receptor site that matches, an antenna that matches, and then it lands on the cell. Now, what the cell biologists are saying is that this cell then replicates the neuropeptide. I don't believe the cell replicates the neuropeptide. If you look at my hands in the other direction, when the molecule finds a cell with a receptor site that matches, it inserts itself in the cell. And what shows up in the cell is what we call chemistry. There's no such thing as chemistry, in fact. What it is the energetic pattern, and this part of it solidified looks like chemistry in the cell, but it's really a whole energetic pattern. And when it comes to forgiveness, and you recognize that your energetic pattern, your multi-generational database, has the mind energy of every generation in your bloodline, the skill that ultimately you need to develop, if you're really going to perfect the skill of forgiveness, is you're going to have to learn to go inside of those cells to decode their content and remove the ones that have become your flesh that don't belong in human form. So the skill to be acquired is a skill of being able to go inside and retrieve from your genetic structure. You know, when the geneticists first started researching, they told us that, you know, it was 95% junk DNA. There's no junk DNA. I think the official numbers are now down to about 60% of its junk. There's no junk. It's just the history of your bloodline. When they said the sins of the fathers will be passed to 3 and 4 generations, again, that word sin is just an archery term. It just means off the mark. Anything that's off the mark is an energy that's stored holographically and lands in the cell. It lands in the genes and is passed from generation to generation. And so when you learn the skill of being able to reach in, and it only comes with one of the main skills that Dale's been speaking about. Can I borrow that skill for a minute? Mm-hmm. When you breathe. And that opens the veil, the barrier between what we don't want to be aware of and what we are aware of. There are certain things that we've approved and said, I'm willing to look at this. But when something starts to move in us that we don't want to look at, what we generally do is hold the breath. And holding the breath causes us to dissociate from that mind energy and to no longer be able to decode it. The problem with doing that is because you live in an energetic universe and everything that is in your structure is literally energy in motion and sets up energy waves, then because resonance means motion toward, somebody who's in resonance with that mind energy in you is going to show up in your life. The person with the decoder for what you don't want to decode is going to show up in your life. And you're not going to be happy when they show up because what they do is going to resonate everything you don't want to feel or decode. And so what happens is people shut down the breath. They create an artificial barrier, a veil in their temples. This isn't about a purple curtain in the church when they said the veil of the temple must be rent in twain. The veil is created by locking down and creating this artificial barrier and creating a dissociated mind, a mind that we cannot touch, a mind that is not ours to change. So the very things that you most want to change in your life, as long as you stay in denial, they're hidden from you. And denial looks like you made me. When there's a problem inside, that we keep creating pictures of something that we think is outside, then as Carl Jung said, we live in a dream. We live in the dream that everybody else is doing it to us. But there's a really important piece of the puzzle that we miss. While we're out there proclaiming how everybody else did it to us, we're still feeling the pain of it. Now, there's a test we've developed in this work for determining whether or not something you're feeling is yours or not. And the test goes like this. Are you feeling it? If you're feeling it, you know it belongs to only one person. If you have the capacity for hostility, fear, turmoil, rage, guilt, grief, pain, or trauma, it's because it is an energy in your structure. And until you're willing to capture that and remove it, and it is a skill. I remember several years ago, I bought a computer online. Got the computer, hooked it up, and there was a problem with it. I called tech support, and the tech support people said, you know, we can't do this over line. You're going to have to send it back to us. So I sent it back, and they ostensibly fixed it. I got it back, plugged it in. It was exactly the same. Got online with tech support, sent it back, and they ostensibly fixed it, plugged it in. It was the same. My son did his computer training with a former NASA computer scientist who was a genius with computers but had several businesses going, and he's a good friend of mine, and I didn't like to disturb him. But after the second time of the company that owned the computer, built the computer, when they couldn't fix it, I called Graham. And, Graham, I've got a problem with this computer. Can you help me? He says, sure. What's going on? And so I explained it to him. He says, well, go to a C prompt. I said, what's a C prompt? And he explained how to get to that. And he gave me a string of characters to type in, and I typed them in. And he said, read that back to me. So I read back what came up. He said, okay, type this in. Read that back to me. What's it say? I read it back to him. He said, okay, type this in. It's fixed. Graham, come on. You're kidding me. No, it's fixed. Well, how come that... Michael, it's fixed. Now, how does a NASA computer scientist know that it's fixed? He's developed such skills. You know where Tiger Woods was today? One of the best golfers in the world. You know where he was today? He was on the golf course. He was chipping shots. He was putting. He was driving. If you want to become a master of your life, if you want life and you want it more abundantly, then you're going to have to go over after that set of skills in the same way as a Tiger Woods or the same way as this friend of mine, Graham, had. And as you develop the skill of breathing in the presence of your trauma, of opening to it and moving it, you open the veil of your temple. You open the barrier between the subconscious and the unconscious. And you have access to those things that never belonged in your bloodline. When you have access to those things that never belong in your bloodline, you remove them, you forgive them. You no longer put those things into your brain's image of your brother. What did Yeshua say? You must forgive from your heart, your unconscious, that which you put into your brain's image of everybody else, and you want to believe everybody else is the source of your disturbance. If you're still capable of disturbance, you have a problem. You ever say to somebody, you made me mad. You hurt me. You disturbed me. You really have a problem. You ever say that to somebody? I have a question for you. If they're the one with the problem, why are you the one with the pain? Do you think pain belongs in a device made by love? It doesn't. But your brain can lie to you and make up pictures of how something outside of you is the cause of what's going on inside of you. The skill you need to be developed is the skill of accessing everything that never belonged in your bloodline and removing it so that no matter who shows up, no matter what shows up, you're not capable of pain. That all that is incarnate in your form is the active presence of love, your human life. And if you believe it's about anything else, then you've got all kinds of dramas and traumas that you blame everybody else for. And it's time for us to learn to literally remove the capacity for any form of drama and trauma. You must forgive from your unconscious, from your heart, from your dissociated mind, that which you put into your brain's image of everybody else whenever it's triggered. And you'll notice when people do that, they usually start with their enemies. But if there's no enemy handy, they can use their spouse. And if their spouse isn't handy, they can use that child that was so dear to them. Or any object of attention will do. You remember the forerunner to this mind that was in Christ was who? John the Baptist. What did they call John the Baptist? He was the raving maniac in the desert. The desert is another code word for the unconscious. If you want to truly live in the mind of love, you're going to have to meet your John the Baptist. And John the Baptist is the one who can reach into your unconscious and show you everything that you never wanted to deal with, everything that you never wanted to feel. Now, there were two skills, if you ever decide to play that role for somebody, there were two skills that John had not bothered to develop. And that was, before he confronted someone who was living in a lie, who still had the capacity for some sort of turmoil, confusion, or pain, he confronted them, and when you confront someone in that state with truth, their stress goes up. And most people have their stress attached to the source of the information that shows truth, and they want to get rid of it. So John didn't know when to duck and when to hold the mirror up, and they took off his head. Be careful when your stuff comes up to own it and stop taking off other people's heads. Stop talking about anybody else if you're in pain or turmoil. Because talking about someone else when you're in pain or turmoil is called denial. And when you deny, you dissociate. And what you dissociate from is the only thing that will kill you. If there is a frequency in your cellular structure that can cause disturbance or disease, then you need John the Baptist to bring it up for you. And then you need to breathe.
The veil of the temple was rent in twain. The veil in the doorway of the temple was rent in twain from top to bottom. Ape tareia de haikla. The veil of the temple. First of all, you know, he mentioned a purple curtain in the doorway of the church. It's nice, and there's validity in making a building and putting a curtain there and making the inside of that the holiest of holies, and only the high priest can go in there, whether they actually demonstrate true cosmic love or not. It's just the way it is. Those are the rules. But let's get clear that the holiest of holies is right here. Now, ape tareia de haikla. Haikla is the word for temple. It's the word for church. Haya, I kind of give you haya, give it abundantly. Said that yesterday quite a few times. The word save is haya. Salvation is haya. Resurrection is haya. All these different words that have been translated in all these strange sort of evangelical Christian ways, it's all the same word, and every single one means conscious life energy. When you have haikla, kla is the ka and la, it's a gathering of conscious life energy, and that's the body temple. It's also the word for church, a word for church or sanctuary. But let's go back a little bit. Ape tareia de haikla. Tareia is a word that a lot of people skip over. They just say the veil of the temple, but it's the veil in the doorway of the temple. That word tareia means door, doorway, doorkeeper, or portal. A portal is an opening between two dimensions, between two rooms, between the inside and the outside, whatever you say. Portal, interesting. Go back one more word, which is ape. And this is the word for veil. Ape. Now, pe is an Aramaic letter that means from the mouth. Okay? It means from the mouth. Ape. Intriguingly, when Yeshua said, that in which you judge another, you are guilty of practicing, right after that he called them something. What did he say? Called them a hypocrite. Hypocrite. Hypocrite sounds like this in Aramaic. Ape. It means to puff out from the mouth. Ape also means this. It means veil. We just said that. Ape also means sake. Like, for your sake, Johnny, don't run out into the road. What does that mean? For your what? Safety. For your, I would say, for your apparent safety. Ah, sounds like A Course in Miracles, talking about the safety of the ego, which has no safety in it whatsoever. So we've got veil, we've got hypocrite, we've got sake, but there's something a little closer to that. It also means person. Person in English comes from the Latin word persona, which means mask. Now the ape in the first century was a mask that an actor would wear in a divine play. They would show up on stage with that mask on, and by the end of the play, they would drop their mask and reveal their true inner light and absolute eternal divinity. When someone heard him say ape, they would not have heard hypocrite. That's an English word. They wouldn't have heard veil. That's an English word. They wouldn't have heard sake. That's an English word. What would have been going on for them was, oh, I get it. It's the mask that we wear. You getting what I'm saying? In other words, it's not you that judges the other. It's your mask. It's your, where the 666 was. It's your anti-Christ. It's anything, Christ, remember, Christos, look in Strong's Greek Concordance, open channel of divinity, okay? If you look at that in Greek. Anything that blocks the portal is anti-Christ. Anything. Anything that keeps you from being open is anti-Christ. And you know what's really convenient? If you try to spend decades and hundreds or thousands of years looking and labeling an outside antichrist. Because you know what that does? It enables you to make somebody else the perpetrator. It makes you the victim, and now you can fight against them so that you don't have to take care of any of the dynamics that are already running around in your heart. What is it that Gandhi said? There are no devils in the world except those running around in our own hearts. And I love, Yeshua said in the Gospel of Thomas, that which you bring forth from within you will save you. That which you do not bring forth from within will destroy you. Hmm. Nice.
And they said, take care of the heart, for out of it are the issues in life. Now notice, if you live in the outer eye, you think the issues in your life are somebody else, right? Anybody ever said that to somebody? You made me mad? You made me sad? You made me afraid? Most of the world has this belief that if somebody else hadn't done something, I could be at peace. And that's a lie. The only reason I can't be at peace and in connection with the actual presence of the love that I am and that I live, move, and have my being in is because there's something in me that I don't want to deal with. And that which is in me that I don't want to deal with literally creates a high energy wave that if it's of a destructive nature, of an hostility or fear-based nature, literally is radiating into every cell of my structure continuously and destroying me. So if I speak a word about my disturbance as being your fault, I'm destroying my own cellular structure. And so it's out of my heart, it's out of what I hold within my own denial system, my own dissociated mind, that energetically draws the issues to me that I need to deal with. And then somebody shows up, and what does virtually everybody in the world do when somebody shows up that resonates their disturbance? Well, let me explain to you what's wrong with you. Let me explain to you what you just did to hurt me, to cause me pain. And Yeshua would say, you must forgive from your heart that which you just put into your brain's image of your brother. And as you go in and remove that, and the basic thing that drives the mind to produce the pictures that it does on the inside of our eyeballs, remember we talked about 10,000 brain cells fire, 9 bits of data go into perception. Something drives that system. And when you know what drives that system and what to do with it, then you change that whole system. And what drives it is our goals. You'll notice you've never been upset with somebody who's meeting all your goals. If they say everything the way you want them to say it, they do everything the way you want them to do it, they bring what you want them to bring, and they obey every infantile goal you have for them, notice you're quite happy with them. But when someone violates a goal you have for them, what happens is that goal becomes a driver that causes your mind to use your own dissociated content to build a picture on the inside of your eyeballs that makes it look like it's about them. The core of the forgiveness process, but the core of the forgiveness process looks like this. When I load a goal into my mind that causes my mind to use some kind of disturbing energy in me, hostility, fear, rage, guilt, grief, pain, confusion, whatever it is, when I load a goal that causes my mind to move that energy in me, then I build pictures out of that energy of somebody else and talk about them. That's denial. In Aramaic, the word forgive is shabag or shabak, and it means to cancel. When I realize that what's driving my perceptual system to use my dissociated hostility or fear to produce my brain's image of another, I now live in a dream, as Carl Jung said, who looks without dreams. I live in this dream that everybody else is the problem in my life, and therefore there's no resolution. When I recognize it's my goal that drives the dream, then I shabag the goal. I cancel the goal, which seems totally insane. But when I realize that that goal is driving my perceptual system to use my internal information based in hostility, fear, confusion, rage, whatever it is, then by canceling my goal, I collapse the whole projection. And when this projection collapses in on itself, I drop right into the part of my mind that holds the disintegrative energy, the sin, the energy that's off the mark, that doesn't belong in me. So I open a pathway into that dissociated part of my mind, and as I do, I'm able to bring that information, instead of bringing it forward as pictures of everybody else, by going within, as Jung said, now I've awakened. I'm in direct relationship with that energy. I bring it to the presence of active love, my human life. I ask Ruku Dikuncha, the super processor, for support, and all of a sudden I process through that, and my temple is freed from that. I've opened the veil of my temple with forgiveness and removed what didn't belong. And that's all been misinterpreted to be about some kind of building 2,000 years ago. And it becomes irrelevant to who you are today. Are you still capable of any former hostility or fear? Notice that when it comes up, you talk about somebody else. That's the whole game of the world. Buy into the world's denial system and make it everybody else's fault. We can never drop into the part of us that is our disease and heal it. You've got to crack open the veil. It's done with forgiveness. It seems totally backward to have a perfectly wonderful, awesome, sweet, tremendous goal and cancel it. But I collapse the picture that keeps me focused out there, thinking the problem's out there, and I get to drop into where the real problem is. And when I remove what disturbs my peace of mind, then I get to incarnate as a human being. There's work to be done. That part of your mind. And then invite Ruka Dikuncha to assist you to process whatever that's about. It's the most amazing process you'll ever see when you actually use it. First century Aramaic forgiveness.
One of the strangest things that I really, that brought up a lot of stuff for me that I had to remove so that I didn't recreate it within my own system, I was flabbergasted when I got deep into some of these scholarly realms and into these rooms, and I was so, it completely made no sense to me how I saw these theological frames and fences that were passed down for thousands of years, and how there was almost no one who was interested in moving those frameworks to the side and say, maybe, just possibly, over the course of 2,000 years, maybe one little thing here and there was possibly not quite correct. Maybe there's just a couple of things that aren't quite
completely in high fidelity. But you know what? You can only hold so many corks on a lake down. And now that the internet is out and everything on the internet is true, right? Now that the internet's out here, you can't stop it anymore. It's out there and it's coming out. And the young ones that are coming in, they don't have the indoctrination. I realize I'm not doing this for us anymore. I'm doing this honestly for the young ones. I'm doing this to help us let go and be open and forgive what's in our hearts so that they can come in and we don't need to indoctrinate them and drug them down and dumb them down and dump all this garbage on top of their heads to feed the economic, political, and religious beast anymore. We can just let them be exactly who they are. And that's exactly what all of the Yeshua teachings are about. And to know that I'm right here beside you, it's like, come on, with Mikael, the great angel himself. So
notice that many